Welcome to the Scottish Football Coaching Podcast, taking you around the country, shedding light on the work of the Scottish FA from grassroots to coach development, and taking a look at the future of our game.
From playing on the street as a young boy, to starring in the Premier League and making history for his country, Scotland legend James McFadden sits down with Lewis Irons and Greg Patterson to discuss his coaching journey.
Back for another coaching journey, Greg. Here we are, the podcast returns, and I'm delighted to say that we've got James McFadden on this episode. It's been one I'm looking forward to, I have to be honest. We've got a lot to get through, but Faddy, thank you very much for joining us, mate. It's a pleasure to have you on.
No problem. I'm looking forward to it. Should be good.
Greg, where do we begin really with Faddy? With obviously an exciting point in his career. It's great to have him on to discuss coaching in general. He's about to obviously kickstart the pro licence. But from your side of things, what do you make of having Faddy on the podcast?
It's brilliant. I remember being in the terraces. You know, Faddy's probably scored some of the most iconic Scotland goals of recent times, hasn't he? So, you know, to probably see that transition for myself from watching him in the terraces to actually being or leading coach education programmes that Faddy's been on, you know, the A licence and now into the pro licence is just fantastic. But I suppose testament to him, although he's sitting there looking at us just now, is, you know, just how grounded he is throughout all that, and how open and receptive he has been to all the coach education programmes that we've done, and how supportive as well he's been for a lot of things that have happened within the Scottish FA.
Yeah. Faddy, I've been lucky enough to work alongside you a couple of times. So we've got some stuff that we'll get to, Motherwell and recent times. But if we go right back to the start of your career, mate, where it all began, of course, Motherwell. But even before then, as a young boy growing up, your earliest memories of football, Faddy?
Just playing on the street. You know, Greg will tell you, I done my wee presentation. And I think it was just playing football. It wasn't, you know, although this probably won't go down well with the SFA and the way the grassroots is going, but there was no structure to it. It was just everybody out in the street, no matter if it was grown men or, you know, different ages, different abilities, sizes, it was just get a game of football. There was nothing else to do, really. So it was just playing in the street, mostly probably getting kicked up and down the street, but it was just everybody kind of came together. To play football, as I said, it was dads, it was uncles and all that playing. So yeah, just playing in the street and honing your craft, really. It was no structure to it, so it was do what you want, dribble, score goals, kick people, do whatever you want, and it was a great grounding for me.
I guess it's not surprising to hear that, Greg, because when people talk about James McFadden and everything he did for Scotland and his club career, he's the sort of player that Scotland hasn't really produced all that frequently, that expressive talent that we're probably crying out for at times, but it probably comes from that grounding that Faddy talks about there.
I think it absolutely does. You know, and I talked earlier, I mentioned those kind of iconic goals, and those iconic goals are probably from, you know, what the hell is he doing shooting from there? Oh my God, he's just scored, you know? And that's probably where it comes from. And he's right, he spoke about it passionately on the pro licence recently. We asked everyone to do an introductory presentation, and he spoke passionately about the grassroots game. And given what he's achieved in the game as a player, to always hark back to those memories about them, those moments and those experiences, you know, the mixed age play that he talks about, the lack of structure in games. It's just playing the game and a love for the game that's obviously afforded him the opportunity to learn a lot. It's taken him, you know, and served obviously very well as a professional player. But I think there's a message in there for coaches listening as well, that, you know, sometimes it's not about the most fancy structure sessions at grassroots play as well. And I have that conversation quite often, you know, when I help with my wee boys grassroots teams. You know, and it's sometimes the coaches get caught up in having to have this perfect session. Sometimes it's not. Just let them play.
That's not just grassroots though, Greg. That's throughout. I think there's... Mm-hmm. I've said it before. I think it was Bill Shanklin says football's a simple game complicated by idiots. And I'm no, you know, I'm not saying that the guys in charge are idiots, but I think they lose why they're doing it. You're doing it to help the kids. A lot of coaches do it and they think, right, I'm going to show everybody I'm clever, I know what I'm talking about, and forget really why they're doing it. It's not about the coach, it's about the kids, it's about the player. Having that, you know, environment to develop, And my biggest thing about football, it was the obviously hard work, but throughout my whole career was passion and love for the game. Yeah. And if you're like restricting, especially at a young age, if you're restricting kids, pass it, get into shape, do this, do that, the kids, they don't know what they're doing, why they're doing it. They make mistakes. They don't even know they're making mistakes. And in the end, they just get fed up with pass it, get into shape, do this, do that, you're doing this wrong. Let them have as much freedom to go and make mistakes, because everybody makes mistakes, but certainly at a young age, go and make mistakes. If you continue to make the same mistake, then you step in. But if you're, if you don't have that freedom, it's great, and you'll know, because everybody's got a plan, and it looks great, and it, you absolutely need it, 100% need a plan. You need to know what you're doing. But when the game starts, the plan changes every second, quicker than that. And the players need to be able to deal with that and adjust. And if they're being told, right, this is what we're going to do, when this happens, if that doesn't work, try this. If that doesn't work, try that. They need to figure it out for themselves on the pitch, because only they can see what they can see. Now, that might be that much. Can we make it so it's that much?
Yeah.
But they've got to make the decisions for themselves.
Yeah. Have to have that ability to think for themselves, really, don't they? I guess you, particularly with young players, I'm sure as well, Father, you could testify, and you can probably see your points in football, that particularly young players need that ability to express themselves, think for themselves, and if they become too taught, too coached, that they're going to limit where they can maybe go.
Yeah, I think they need that freedom. They need to go and enjoy it. And you need to remember when you were that age, and you always remember a coach or a person saying to you, I've forgot more than you know. And that is true. But at that age, your outlook's so small that you've no idea what's ahead of you.
Yeah.
So you've got to harness that and allow them to go and make... They don't mean to make mistakes. Yeah. They don't mean to make the wrong decisions. Can we make them make less of those mistakes? Can we help them to understand maybe why they're doing it, and is there an alternative, without telling them every kick of the ball, kick it here, kick it there, he's on, do that, turn. Like, you need all these shouts, but no, you shouldn't be telling them what to do every time they've got it, because in the end, they'll stop thinking.
Yeah.
And they won't make the decisive pass. It'll be a safe pass. There's my guy beside me. He can have it. And it's a pass the buck. You can pass it to lend it, to get it back, to see the picture as it moves, and then see the pass. But too many, it's in front of people, side to side. And it plays into the coaching shaping up, because you shape up, you slide across, and you don't need to come out your slot, and it becomes very easy to play against, and it also becomes very boring to watch, because you're like, well, we're not getting shots, we're not getting, you know, crosses into the box.
You need to
be expressive within reason. It's not just right, everybody go and do what they want. There's got to be a structure to it, but when you're getting at that top end of the pitch especially, you've got to allow, you know, expression.
Yeah.
I think it becomes even more important, Lewis, now as well. You know, Faddy's talking about, you know, him growing up and, you know, playing in the street, he spoke about, and playing against uncles and different ages and different abilities and getting kicked and all that kind of stuff that he spoke about earlier. I think that becomes even more important now for our grassroots coaches that are perhaps listening to this, because unfortunately kids don't play in the streets. We don't see that same prevalence of people playing in parks and people playing on their own, you know, just that informal play. You know, Faddy probably had that informal play and his grassroots club at the time, whereas now it's just the grassroots club. So even more so, and I often talk myself out this job and role that I'm in, don't I, in this? But, you know, it's not about being a coach.
Yeah.
I think they've got to just, I think as grassroots coaches, a lot of the time we've just got to give them that informal play, let them play as much as we can, set up different game formats, and it's all that. You know, that's the way we've changed our coach head as well.
We're talking about the coaches. That comes for the parents as well, because if a parent looks
100%,
and it's no a structure, and they've seen somebody else who does all these drills, they don't know what the drills are, they don't know why they're doing them, they don't know what effect it's having, but somebody else looks like they're doing it better.
The parents expect a level of coaching that the kids don't need, and they look elsewhere and see other, you know, grassroots teams that the coaching looks better. And I'm not saying it's the right or wrong way, but the parents have got a lot to answer for. I've got two boys that play, so I know, I understand the amount of time, the sacrifice that these grassroots coaches put in. So I would never criticise them. I never ever challenge them, because they're putting the time in, and I know the answers to what I say is going to be, right, well, you do it. And that's the same for everybody, and that's what the parents need to think about. Before you go and criticise a guy that's given up all his time and effort to put on the best that he can do, just have a think. Would you be willing to give that up for another group of 20 kids or that? So it's not just the coaches. I think everybody needs to look at it and say, right, how can we make it better? Lower the expectation. Football is about fun for me. You've got to enjoy it. It's any line of work you do or any hobby that you do, if you're not enjoying it, don't do it. Simple as that. Don't do it. So they've got to enjoy it, but they've got to be allowed to have that freedom. I'm going to keep saying it. They need to, the kids need to go and really learn. It's like when parents, the kids get homework at school, how many parents sit and do the homework for them? Because it gets out of the way. The reason they're doing it is for the kids to show that they're actually taking in what they're learning it in class. No,
that's true. Yeah.
So they have to, they need to learn for themselves.
Yeah, no, that's 100% true, and I've been through that process as well, Lewis, as we've spoke about quite often. You know, and you know, having my two boys playing, and I was very much of that ilk. What's the point in going to a 4v4 game format on a Sunday morning that's 40 minutes away, and you need to drag the kids out of their bed even earlier and get them? We can just play locally. I had about 40 kids in the own age group. Let's just get them in a local park and let's just let them play. Yeah. But it was the parents. Why are we not playing against such and such? I speak to such and such at work, and his wee boy's playing in a tournament, and her wee boy's playing in a tournament every Sunday morning. What's the difference in a six-year-old 40 minutes away as a six-year-old that's on your doorstep? And as Faddy says, it was fun. Let's just get them playing locally as much as we possibly can, rather than this added pressure of getting out of your bed earlier to drive for 40 minutes to then get beat and get worried about score lines and stuff like that. Just let's just play, have fun and enjoyment, and enjoy the game, and then we can kick on in later life.
Yeah, and in those early days then for you, Faddy, obviously from playing on the street all the time and honing your craft in that way and becoming a player first and foremost on the street like that, to then going in at Motherwell and starting to make your way in the game initially at 17, what was that like, trying to adapt initially going into a club like Motherwell at a young age?
It was tough, because when you get to, like, pro youth started at my age when I was 14, so that was when pro youth came in. So then it was, I always got it, pass the ball, you don't know when to pass it, you need a ball to yourself. I didn't care. I really didn't care. That was my enjoyment, and I didn't understand, if I was beating people and making things happen, then why not continue to do it? So that's what I'm talking about, when you don't have that knowledge at that age. So you just go, I don't care. I just want to play. And I got it through my whole time. And getting into Motherwell, it was tough, because I went in and I was a left winger, but I was never the quickest. So and I always wanted to dribble. So it was pass the ball, get your head up, all these things, which is good advice and trying to make the decision making better. So they thought I wasn't quick enough, so I got moved to left back, because I could get forward, I could run up and down. Contrary to popular belief, I could run up and down all day. So I played left back. That I'd done quite well there. I played centre mid, I played right wing. So that was helped me learn the game. Different positions, different requirements within those positions actually helped my all-round game. And it was, you know, I always had belief, but it was tough getting into a full-time environment. You realise that, yes, you're still doing it because you love it, but then it is a job to you now. Yeah. You need to go, there's other sides to it, there's pressures. You've got a manager, Billy Davis, who was a brilliant manager, great coach, demanded, you know, such high standards, was on you every single day, and you had to be strong to deal with it. And I had, Billy was my under-15s coach at Motherwell, so I had a relationship with him. Yeah. And he was brilliant as a under-15s manager, always laughing, always joking. But then you go into a first team full-time environment, and he was still laughing and joking, but he was a manager, and he was so hard on you. I mean, I remember training with the first team because I was only 16 and I'd made an impression as soon as I went in. So I was training with the first team now and again. And I trained one day, I was playing left back and the goalkeeper threw the ball out to me and I went to control and it rolled right under my foot, right out for a throw-in. And he went absolutely mental. He's like, you've got 5 minutes, I'm telling you. If you don't buck up your ideas, I'm going to go and get Betty. You know, she was the secretary at the time, the kit man's mother-in-law. I'm going to phone Betty and I'm going to tell her to come pick you up. And training just started. So I was like, oh no. Right, don't shout for the ball. Just get through this 5 minutes and then we'll see how it goes. In the end, I finished the training session, but it was just a measure of the standard that Billy demanded. It was like, it happens, you know, you take your eye off the ball, you're thinking about what you're going to do next, but that was a lesson in itself. Like, take care of the ball. That is, the goalkeeper's rolling out to a left back. That should happen 100 times in a game. And 100 times out of 100, you'll control it and take the right touch to move forward. But I didn't that day, so... that was a wake up. But Billy was like that. He was so intense, but he was absolutely brilliant, and it was a great grounding for me because, you know, I played for the under 18s, and I never actually ever done that well for the under 18s. But because we had such a small squad, you played for the under 18s on a Saturday morning or a Friday, and then you played for the under 20s on a Monday night, and I always done better in the under 20s. But I got to a stage, you know, Mickey Weir was my coach. Mickey Weir was absolutely brilliant. Just the perfect guy for bringing in 16-year-old boys and making them men and making them understand what's required. Not so much, well, I'm talking about coaching. It was coaching. I don't specifically remember drills or anything that Mickey taught us. It was all about the person and growing up and taking responsibility. And having the right attitude. So Mickey was great for that, getting you to understand your body. One time we had a couple of days off, and when I was that age, I didn't go out, I didn't drink. I just wanted to play football, and I wanted to look after myself as much as I could. And we had 2 days off, and I came in the Monday, and I was knackered. I was sluggish, and Mickey was like, what's wrong with you? I says, I don't know. He says, what'd you do at the weekend? I says, I never done anything. Just sat in the house. Just chilled out. He says, well, maybe that's what's wrong. He says, you can't take 2 days off. So one of those days, go for a run, go for a jog, go for a walk, just be active. And that stuck with me. You know, I was 16 or 17, and that stuck with me my whole career. I took days off, and obviously as you get older, you do different things, but... I always had that worry that, right, don't take too many days off. Make sure you're ticking over. Make sure you're ready. And I mean, you're not going to lose fitness in 2 days, but that was a mental side. It was like, right, if I train or if I go for a run or go to the gym, I'll be flying on Monday. I'll be flying after those 2 days off. So these are things that you need to learn. It's great having all your coaching. Of course, you need that, but you need to learn about how to look after yourself and what's right for you. It's not right for everybody, but it's what's right for you. And the grounding I got at Motherwell was brilliant because the early doors, as I said, everybody was pass it. And then, you know, I made my debut. I shouldn't have been in the club at the time when I made my debut. It was Christmas, and the guys that stayed closer to Firth Park, there was a game on Boxing Day, so they were in for the kit and setting up training. And then there was a rota for the match day, so I wasn't even meant to be in. So I got a phone call on Boxing Day to say, you need to come in, clear snow off the pitch. And my dad was all excited. He's like, you're going to be on the bench. He says, don't be so stupid. I've not trained for 4 days. I've not even been in the club. We've had Christmas off. But I got in, and then it was clearing the snow off of the covers. And Billy Davis called me into his office. He says, look, we've had, I don't know, 6 or 7 call-offs, you need to go on the bench. Wow. I was like, brilliant. You need to go on the bench, as if I was doing him a favour. I was like, absolutely brilliant. He says, don't worry, you'll get on. And I couldn't believe it. And then I came on and played the last 30 minutes, and we got beat 3-0 off of Dundee. But I came on the pitch with guys like Andy Gorham and Pat Nevin and guys like that you see growing up, and I used to see them training, and It just when they spoke to you, you'd be absolutely buzzing because they were passing stuff on to you. So to get on the pitch with them was brilliant, and it was so unexpected, but it just shows you that at that time things probably weren't going as great for me as I thought, or maybe they were going better than I thought. But in my mind, you know, a month or two before it, Mickey Weir had says to me, listen, you need to sort yourself out. They're talking about letting you go. You're on your way out the door. And I was like, what? It was a shock to me because I didn't think I was doing terribly, but I don't know if it was wee Mickey's mind games, because for that point on, I thought, well, stuff this. I'm just going to go and play for me. If I'm on my way at the door, I may as well go and make the most of it and go enjoy it. So within a month or two, I was in the first team, made my debut, and I went on to make, I think, 4 or 5 appearances that season, which at 17, I was absolutely buzzing.
Of course. Absolutely. I'm now getting the thought of you making that debut and still being worried about Betty coming to pick you up.
Oh, no, we're on it left wing. I was all right. Go and run it, people. That was it.
And obviously things from there then really take off. We all know what happens, but you go on to have an incredible season in 2002-03, scoring about 19 goals and Young Player of the Year and everything, and the move that followed. At that point, when you have build momentum like that, Faddy, and you're having the season that you're having, what are managers saying to you at that point in terms of trying to keep getting the best out of you every game?
Well, because Billy had left and Eric Black came in, and then this was the season before it. So Eric Black came in, brilliant coach, great guy, just kind of a continuation from Billy in terms of the demands that he expected. But, like, this is bizarre as well, because when he first came in, it was like, right, everybody's getting a fair crack. But I come on, I think it was his first game, I come on as a sub, because I wasn't a regular, I come on as a sub, and I kicked the ground and I hurt my left foot, and it was agony. But I thought, I've got a new manager here, I'll need to continue. And I couldn't even side foot it with my left foot. So I just started using my right, and I couldn't kick it properly for about 3-4 weeks. So I just started using my right foot, to the point where I think he might have thought I had a rubbish right foot, more than likely, but I think he thought, he must be right-footed. So I come on in the right wing against Aberdeen, and I scored my first goal. And it kind of, that next month, I think month or two was crazy, because I was coming on here and there, and I was coming on in the right, and then my left foot was fine. So they must have thought, he's got two no bad feet. Know that people think that, they think I kind of use my right. But then David Kelly was signed by Billy Davis, and he was like, him and I think Roberto Martinez was there, Scott Leach. There was a few older players, but not many of them. A lot of them had left. And then we played Celtic, and I played up behind David Kelly, in behind the strikers, a number 10. First time I'd played it in the first team, and I'd done quite well. And then we played Dunfermline in the cup, and David Kelly had an argument with Eric Black. And it was like, it was a stupid argument, but he kind of undermined Eric Black, or tried to undermine him. But Eric was strong and just told him to leave, got rid of him, left the club, and then with no strikers. So Eric's like, right, go and play up front. And I was like, brilliant. Everybody wants to play up front. I don't know what I'm doing, but just run about. Everybody wants to play up front. So I think we played Dundee at home. I scored 2 goals, and that was in January. And then by the end of January, I'd scored 5 goals in 4 or 5 games. So that was me. I was a striker. And it just kicked on from there. We got to the end of the season. I think we just avoided relegation. Mm-hmm. And then Terry Butcher had taken over as manager. And for that point, I was one of the strikers. So if it wasn't for, you know, circumstance, like anybody, you need a bit of luck. It's not all luck, but you need a wee bit of fortune.
Yeah.
And I certainly got it, because I'd never played, even probably in the reserves or in the youth team, I'd never really played as a striker.
Yeah.
So to get that opportunity, then coming into the next season, Terry Butcher came in, and Terry Butcher was amazing for the group that we had. The club obviously went into administration, and Terry was assistant, but he stepped up to be the manager. And every single day in training, if it was a passing drill, if it was a crossing, shooting, anything, it was nothing but encouragement. If you hit a pass and it dropped short, 5, 10 yards short, he'd shout at you and stop training and say, look, I'd rather hit it 5 or 10 yards beyond them because you're committing to the pass as opposed to playing it safe and dropping short and then you're putting your team under pressure. So for the group of players that he had, Terry Butcher was absolutely brilliant. He had these moments. I think he's got this, people have got this perception that he's nuts and he shouts, and but he was so good for us as young players, full encouragement. He had a demand about him, but the biggest demand was just work hard and try your best. And more often than not, we done that, but obviously it didn't work out too well because we finished bottom of the league. But he had a group of young players that went on to do so well in the game. And that was largely down to Terry's encouragement and his probably strength to continue playing young. For every good game, there was 5 or 6 absolutely honking games, terrible games. But there was always that chance that I could do something, and Terry recognised that, so he kept me in and always encouraging. It was great, as I said, for that group of players at that time.
Yeah. I guess, Greg, when you hear that, young player and James McFadden at the time with this talent, and then somebody like Butcher who's encouraging him to work as hard as he does. And I'm sure he did work hard, Faddy, anyway, but then having a manager push someone like that, Greg, that's going to be a great combination, isn't it?
So many different, I think, sound bites in there, Lewis, that Faddy spoke about. You know, he talked about maybe being lucky when he got the opportunity to start playing at striker. Now, I don't think it's luck necessarily. You know, he spoke throughout this podcast about, you know, I'm back to that mixed age play again when he was playing in the street, and then he spoke about playing for not just the under 18s but also the under 20s. He spoke about playing left wing, he spoke about playing left back, he spoke about playing centre mid, all these different. So I don't think it's luck necessarily, all those different experiences. You know, people talk about the 10,000 hour rule, and I think Nick Cox that we'd done before, he'd spoke rather about 10,000 experiences standing you in good stead. And I think all those different experiences that Faddy's had throughout that kind of not just grassroots career, but then into the pro youth and playing all those different positions and playing for two different teams and training with the first team and all those different experiences has then, I think, afforded him that opportunity perhaps.
I don't like saying luck because then people go, that's lucky. I don't mean it was luck, it was just fortune. The
opportunity arose.
You know, I wouldn't have played as the main striker had David Kelly not fell out with Eric Black.
Yeah.
Maybe I would have further down the line. Maybe that was the progression. That was the plan. I just mean at that point in time, there was fortune in me to get the opportunity to play as striker.
Yeah.
I wasn't
yeah.
lucky that I scored 2 goals in that game and then it carries on from there. It was just fortune that for that game in particular, we had no striker and the manager thought I was the best option, and it proved to be. I scored 2 goals, we won 4-2, and then, as I said, I went on a good scoring run.
Yeah.
So there is a bit of luck in terms of the circumstance, but I'm not saying that what happened after that is continued luck.
No, and then you've had that preparatory work, if you like, you know, all those different experiences that have stood you in good stead. And then, as you say, Lewis, the likes of Terry Butcher that he spoke about, well, actually he's come in and, you know, added that hard work rate and added, you know, everything else that maybe was needed to help that young group of players that Faddy speaks about.
Yeah. A couple of managers throughout your career, Faddy, that I'm really looking forward to talking to you about. Of course, Alex McLeish, but before that, David Moyes as well. Get that move. You go down to Everton, 20 years of age, pressure on you around the price tag that's paid for you. How do you handle that at that point? Because that's a young age to be dealing with all that stuff.
You just handle it. It's just as soon as I broke into the first team, as soon as I started that goal scoring run, there was always talk about teams being interested. You know, the first maybe after you know, my half season, if you like, my breakthrough season. There was maybe, oh look, this young boy's going to go and, you know, do something good. I think I actually made my debut for Scotland at the end of that season.
Yeah,
I'm trying to think.
Scotland, wasn't it under Bertie Volks at you?
Aye, was it 2000? No, it was 2002. I think I made my debut for Scotland. So after that, you know, burst or breakthrough, I'd made my Scotland debut by the end of that season, and then, you know, coming into the upcoming season, it was all about just going and playing football. You know, people would say this team and that team. There was a lot of speculation in the paper. I just really got on with it. It didn't really bother me. I just wanted to play football and score goals, and we always set small targets. And I just used to think, right, can I get a goal every week? And as daft as that sounds, you know, to play for a team that eventually finishes bottom and have a target to score 30 odd goals in a season sounds mad, but just approach every game and say, right, can I get a goal? Can I get a chance? Can I affect the game? And then the speculation comes, and at the start, it's good just to see your name in the paper and hear people talking about you. But then you quickly realise that, you know, every team you're linked with isn't necessarily a team that's watching you. You know, I had a chance to... I knew of interest from Bayer Leverkusen before I went to Everton. And I knew they were coming to watch me, and there was a plan that they were going to go and buy me and leave me at Motherwell for 6 months, learn the language, and then go over. And I think that was the year that they won, they were in the Champions League final. So that was like, wow, you know, I've got a chance to go and move to Germany and play for Bayer Leverkusen at the time, were a top side, and I was, you know, I couldn't believe it. But that fell through. I think Motherwell wanted too much money. But I just thought, oh, well, you know, I'm quite happy here anyway. I wasn't devastated. I never thought, anything other than, all right, well, I'll just keep playing. And then there was different bids over the course. And I think by the time that I'd left, it was probably the right time. You know, I'd played a season and a half. Yeah. I think I scored 30-odd goals. And considering I wasn't a natural striker, then I think it was time for me to go. And going to Everton, as you say, with the price tag, it never bothered me. You know, it's like any time now in football, if somebody's willing to pay that money, that's what you're worth. So it's up to you to go and do what you do best and continue to try and develop, try and get better. I always remember when I signed, David Moyes was, he never gave much away. So he would say, right, you're one for the future. And I was like, nah. So I'm not here to mess about. I don't want to be waiting a year, 2 years, a development. I want to play in the first team. And he was looked at me as if I had two heads. I says, no, I'm here to play. I'm not here to be a youth player. I've served my apprenticeship. I've played, you know, 60, 70 games for Motherwell, played for my country. I says, I'm not here to, you know, join a reserve team. And I don't know, I think he would have liked it. I don't think he'd have liked me talking back to him like that, but I think he would have liked the attitude of, right, okay, let's see what you've got. And again, you know, I played in a League Cup game against Stockport, and I was excellent, played left wing. And I think that's when he thought, all right, well, maybe he can do it. So then I'd come on as a sub, I think, the weekend before to make my debut away to Middlesbrough. And then we played Leeds at the weekend after the League Cup game, and I was starting. And I was like, yes, I told you I'm no one for the future. So we played that game, and honestly, it's one of the best games I've ever had. I was absolutely brilliant. Steve Watson scored a hat trick, and I think I got man of the match in the game. So it tells you how well I'd done. And I played against Gary Kelly, who had umpteen caps for Ireland, top player. And I thought I got the better of him, and I thought, this is brilliant. You know, this guy's a top player. I've just absolutely got the better of him. This is going to be easy. So then the next week we played Tottenham away, and it was Stephen Carr, who was a right back for Tottenham. And I thought, right, I've just beat Ireland's best right back. This will be easy. And it wasn't that I switched off. I just thought, I'm going to go and play my game. I'm on a high, White Hart Lane, what a place to play football, and I got absolutely bullied for the start of the game to the end. Stephen Carr, I couldn't run him. He was tight when I went to take a touch. I couldn't go by him. It was like one of the hardest games I've ever played. I went from the best to the worst in a week, and that showed maybe I was one for the future. But these are the experiences that you don't get if you're continuing saying to a player, right, if you do this, this will happen, and then if you do that, that will happen. And within the space of a week, I'd went from thinking I was absolutely amazing to thinking I was absolutely rubbish in the space of a week. And I thought, right, I need to mix my game up here, because when I went down the line, he stepped across, took the ball off. If I come inside, he was there. If I tried to lay it off, he was tight. I couldn't get turned. Couldn't run him. I couldn't affect the game. And that's developing. That's learning.
Absolutely. Yeah. The good point Fadi makes said, Greg, about going in, speaking to David Moyes and saying, no, I'm not one for the future. One of Fadi's traits that we spoke about at the start of this was that grounded, down-to-earth attitude. There's, I bet you if a young boy went in and had an air of arrogance about Moyes, there you go. But hunger, who's true to himself, saying, no, I want this. And then he's gone out there. And it is a learning curve, and I see the highs and lows, but he's got an honest player there who's wanting to give it all for his club.
Absolutely does. And I think it's probably all my experiences and conversations with Fadi's probably reflected that over the years. And I'm not saying I know him hugely well, but even when, you know, he was involved with the senior international team, he would come over to the desk and just sit and chat. And that was something that he just... In my mind, anyway, Fadi just couldn't get right in his head that, you know, there wasn't that hunger and passion and desire from all those players that he's been dealing with, you know, when he started his coaching career and then moved into the Scotland international team. And it was that hunger and desire and the passion, it just born out of that love. We're back, way back cyclically again to the grassroots game, aren't we? That just born out of that love and passion he's got for the game.
Has that always been something, Fadi, that you've consciously had to do? Because I'm sure there are times when you are doing as well as you are and you're getting moves like that and you're at a high level that it'd be easy to become maybe a bit big-headed. Is that something you've always just had, or have you had to work at that?
No, I think it's just the way I am. I don't, you know, I think you can know that you're doing well, but like the story I've just told is a quick reminder that 1 week you can be doing great, the next week you can't. And I think it's just the grounding that I've had. You know, I spoke about, you know, upbringing in the street. Everybody thought they were the best player. You argued and you fought to see who was the best, but everybody was the best. And you'll have guys that say, about every player, not just me, but you'll have guys that say, I don't know how he made it, I was better than him. And it might have been true at the time, but I just think it's just the way I am. I just think why would you change? You know, I went when the darkest times at Motherwell, we didn't have a training pitch to train on. You know, we had to put a trailer on the back of the minibus, take the goals, build the goals, put the nets on, put up all the training equipment and train on a spare bit of ground at Glasgow Green, because the club could not afford half a pitch on a public park. We could not afford half a pitch. So it was a spare bit of grass. So for all, it's great. The facilities are all amazing now. That'll never leave me, because I went on and achieved far more than I ever could dream of. But I never forget that the times that I trained on the spare bit of grass were just as good, if not better, than the times I played on the best pitches with the, you know, the best facilities, and that would never leave me. I just think it's so. I was fortunate. I was at two clubs at the start of my career. Motherwell, small family club, still the same. It's run. Everybody knows each other. I moved to Everton, who on the face of it are a massive club. They are a massive club, but the training ground was like old, and all the staff were like Everton fans. You sat in amongst everybody for lunch. You've seen every member of staff that worked at that training ground every single day. And it was never, that's their place, that's my place, that's their, it was everybody was in the same place, working towards the same thing. And I was probably fortunate in that you got, you, it's not that you had to, you wanted to get to know them, but you got the chance to get to know everybody in the club. You got to know what they done, their job, how hard they worked. You could see it. There was nobody saying, I'm more important than you, I'm doing this, I'm doing that. Of course you get the banter, but I think we all recognised that everybody was in it together. We all wanted the same thing, and that was Everton winning at the weekend. And the best way to do that at that point was for everybody to be together.
It's only going to bring good things when you've got a club and banter like that, isn't it, Faddy? You've had so many examples of that, and when things work well. And I guess if you then transition from that to the international scene a bit when you're first on it, 2002, like you say, and then start to establish yourself a bit under Betty Vokes initially in 2003. What was it like on the international scene back then? I know a lot of people maybe speculate and talk about Vokes' time, but what was it like?
At the start, it was weird because, like, my first real involvement with Betty Vokes and the full squad was a trial. Yeah. I'd never heard it before. It was like, get everybody that's eligible for Scotland, that's half decent, get them together, get some training, play some practice matches, and then we'll try and find some players. And some players done well and managed to get through, but there were some players you're thinking, I mean, you didn't even know some of them. But Bertie recognised that, you know, Craig Brown done a magnificent job, but all these players were coming to the end of their international career. Probably 80-90% of them called time on their international career. And Bertie needed to find players, and we didn't have there was no procession. There was nobody ready to step up, so we had to find a group of players, which played into my hands because he tried a lot of young ones, and it was good. I thought Bertie was really good. Obviously got us to the playoffs, but he had a tough job. You know, he came in and he had to find all these players. I think, you know, probably around about the midpoint, he managed to get a good team together. And I just, you know, I couldn't believe I'd managed to get called up for the trial match, never mind actually going and playing for Scotland. So I just treated it like you might not be asked back. So every time you go, just try your best. And to be fair, there was a lot of guys like that. The standard of training was great because it was guys hungry to prove that they're good enough to, first of all, to show everybody else, you know, look, I'm good, look at me. But also, obviously, to impress the manager and the coaching staff to get in the team. And he had a tough job, Bertie, but I think under the circumstances, he'd done well because it was brave to go and try and find these players. You know, as much as people don't like it, there was no, it's all right saying, let's build a team, and managers don't get time to build teams. They need to try and find ready-made players that can go and affect the game, go and get your qualification, especially on a national level. You don't get time. You maybe get a campaign, two campaigns at most, but you've not got time to go and work with the players and bring a system, or, you know, really get them together. You've got 10 days. Well, you get more time back then. Yeah, you get 10 days, but it's not enough time to go and build. So he done a good job under the circumstances. And if you look at the players that he did bring in, a lot of them have went on to do really well for Scotland, you know, in the future, which kind of flies in the face of what I'm saying about building. But the one manager doesn't get a chance to build. So it's trying to find that balance.
Lewis, I need to jump in here, sorry, and tell my Bertie Vokes story. And Faddy, you might correct me if I'm wrong here, because you're going back 18 years. But if I'm not mistaken, my memory, Scotland under 21s played Ghana down at Palmerston, down at Queen of the South.
Yeah.
And you were in that squad, and I was the international liaison officer or whatever. You know, Frank had asked me to go down there, and away down I went to help Ghana out, to basically live with Ghana down in Dumfries and help them with their training and getting to the stadium, etc. I then got a phone call to meet Rainer Bonhoff, who was under 21 manager, and Bertie Vokes in a hotel, and I thought it was a wind up. So anyway, I went along, and there was Rainer and Bertie sitting waiting for me. Now the plan was at that time, Faddy, that Bertie essentially said, tonight James McFadden will play against Ghana, but I'm going to substitute him after, I think he said something, maybe after something like 70 minutes. And then I want you to organise a car to get him from Queen of the South to Easter Road.
Yep.
Okay? And tomorrow night, he'll play against, I think it was Canada?
Canada,
the Easter Road. Tomorrow night, he'll play against Canada. So, you know, Faddy's talking about Bertie Vogts building now. There's something, and I remember you were doing quite well in the game. And, of course, the maybe 1,000, 2,000 fans that were at the game. And it was old-fashioned days, Lewis, when the Tuesday nights under 21 would play and then the Wednesday night the first team would play. That was kind of what used to happen. So Faddy got hooked after 70 minutes, but the plan was that he was then getting in a car, I think, if I'm not mistaken. To then travel through to Edinburgh. So Faddy's talking about Bertie building. So there's an example of, and I think it was actually you and Gary Caldwell. I'm not sure Gary played the following evening right enough, but I think that was his plan. His plan might have changed, but that was his plan, was to take Faddy and Gary off and get them through to then play against Canada the following evening. So he spoke to me that day about them having two experiences within 24 hours against teams that they might not necessarily play against.
Well, the reason I was playing in that game is because I was in the full squad. We played Iceland at the weekend. I think it was a Saturday we played Iceland and I never got on. So after the game, I'm like, why am I here? You know, I was delighted to be there, but I'm saying, why are you bringing me here and no playing me? I just want to play. Aye. I just want to play. It was Tommy Burns I was talking to, and Tommy's like, well, you need to look at who's ahead of you. And I says, well, I think it was Stevie Thompson and Stevie Crawford. And I says, well, there's two guys ahead of me that play in the same league as me, and I think I've got the same amount of goals. So, I'm looking at who's ahead of me and thinking I should be playing. And I'm no disrespect to them. So I says, look, if I love being here. If I'm going to go on, great. I says, but like, surely I'm better playing games. He's like, right, fine. You play with the 21s. You play with the 21s on Tuesday. I was like, right, but can I come back to the field? He says, aye, you'll come on against Canada. So that was a wee lesson. You know, although it was a brilliant experience, At that time, I just wanted to play. You know, I wanted to play games, and Bertie dealt with it brilliantly. He sent me down, and I was buzzing just to get a game, and it meant I've actually got to play two games in two days, and it was brilliant. Wee Bertie sent me up the road. You obviously organised it up the road. got to the hotel room, and this thing about you having a beer the night before a game, Bertie, to help you sleep. Just a bottle of beer or whatever, glass of wine. So I got to my room. And there was a room service, a sandwich, and a bottle of beer. Night after a game, night before a game. But I didn't drink beer at that time, so I'd never have done it night before a game, because that would have just put me right off. No. But it was just mad. We barely loved getting the boys together on a Friday night, have a couple of beers. He just did record training back then. Record training. He never used it for analysis. He probably watched it himself, but record training, and come the Friday, they'd have all the best bits, all the best goals or whatever in training, all the outtakes, so if somebody'd messed up or whatever, and you'd sit and have your supper, sandwich, some of the guys drank a glass of wine, bottle of beer, whatever, then go to your bed. So it was great that he managed to, you know, get the guys together. Maybe not the best idea to be putting beer and wine in a room full of Scottish guys, but it had the desired effect for the most part.
Oh, brilliant. That's funny, those stories like there. New demanding a game means, like, get Greg.
Get Greg in.
That's brilliant. Obviously, we know what begins to follow in a Scotland jersey, Faddy. You spoke about the playoff, and obviously your goal against Holland. I'm sure we'll live with you. But Walter Smith soon came in, and things obviously started to from there, and he did really well, obviously, Walter, at that period. And a lot of people spoke about the sort of atmosphere he built at international level. Was that the secret to the success for you at that point?
I think so. I think falling on for Bertie, as I said, they had to find players. He'd bring guys up from youth teams in England to go and play international football, and they just weren't good enough. But by that point, you know, we'd had a lot of time, the squad was starting to really build, and when Walter came in, he just brought it was almost a club-like mentality. The players, everybody, I'm not saying they didn't get on before, we did get on, and as I said, with times where Bertie would bring us all together on a Friday night, and it was before, obviously, your internet, phones and taking your PlayStation and playing in your room with the guy next to you. We had a PlayStation room where 10, 15 guys were sitting in. You had a movie night, go and stick a movie. So the players were encouraging each other to be together. So it was a different kind of era. But when Walter came in, it was just, you know, really hammered home the club side it. You had Walter, you had Tommy Burns, who had worked with Bertie, and you had Alan McCoist. So you had Walter, who was serious, quite dry sense of humour. He wasn't serious all the time. He just had that serious demeanour. And then you had Coyste and Tommy Burns, and it just a perfect balance. And Walter really, he brought in, you know, he was the first really that I'd seen, because me Bertie was a bit creative with his formations at times, and at times it worked, but Walter was like safety first, you know, get a good structure, and we go and play for there, and we had some brilliant performances. And some really good results under Walter, but I think you're right, it was key that he brought in that, you know, the atmosphere was really good under Walter, you know, he had to bring in some young players as well, and some players that maybe weren't ready at times, but he managed to get the best out of us, and that was, you know, I think getting the structure right was probably key to that.
That's all we have time for in part one of James McFadden's Scotland journey. But part two is not to be missed, where the Scotland legend discusses his experiences as a player coach and his spell with Alex McLeish at the national team.